I came to realize through seeing how DNA works and how immunology works that it wasn't possible for there to be no God and no creator. One of the mistakes of the modern West is to focus on rights instead of responsibilities. So everyone keeps talking about, this is my right, I deserve this, I have a right to this, I have a right to that. When you have sexual relationships where you don't care about the other person, you're just doing it for yourself, there is no responsibility in that. So that then becomes, by definition, by religious definition, that's actually an animalistic act, because what defines you as human is being morally responsible. Intimacy is not just about sex. Intimacy is about spending time talking, being close, growing your emotional side, talking about the things that are troubling you in life, sharing emotion. We have a society that's teaching women, don't do the thing that's actually going to make you happy, and definitely don't value that thing. Because what you should be doing to make you happy is being a successful businesswoman and ordering people around.
You're listening to the Visibly Fit Podcast. Hey, I'm your host, Wendy Pett. And every week, I'll give you holistic, practical solutions for everyday issues related to nutrition, healing, functional fitness, and behavior modifications. As a naturopath, fitness expert, and wellness coach for over 20 years, my goal is to empower you to reach for greater health and to rise up to your next level of living in mind, body, and spirit. You were created with greatness in mind. It's time to own it. Are you with me? Then let's dive in. Hello, sweet friend. Thank you so much for joining me here on today's episode of the Visibly Fit Podcast. I am your host, Wendy Pett, and it's always a delight to spend this time with you. Today on the show, we are going to be talking about the world of health and relationships and the science of living well. In almost every episode of the Visibly Fit Podcast, we really do talk about how to be visibly fit, mind, body, spirit, emotions, relationships. All of it matters, right? And we're going to explore today the intersection of physical fitness and emotional well-being. And we're just going to really talk about just some insights, really, that you're going to learn from my guests that will help you lead a more balanced life. And that's what we want, a little more balance in our life. I know I do. Dr. Ricky Aronson, he is not just a physician. He is an award-winning author. He's a speaker, an educator with a passion for helping people thrive. With decades of clinical experience, he combines elements of psychology, neuroscience, and biology seasoned with humor to translate some complex scientific concepts into practical advice. He is an endocrinologist and a geriatrician, and he's based in Melbourne, Australia. Dr. Aronson has garnered accolades for his clinical leadership and mentoring. He's known for making complicated things simple, memorable, and immediately applicable in our daily lives. I think we all appreciate that. Now, his books, we're going to be talking about each one of those just a little bit in the show, include Why Couples Drive Each Other Crazy, Spaceship Parenting, and Cracking the God Code. They delve into relationships, parenting, and faith, offering insights that resonate deeply. And whether he's discussing the age-old mystery of why men can't find the ketchup, and you ladies know what I'm talking about. I just had this issue with my husband, Todd. I'm like, why can't you find that? It's right there. But if we're talking about that interesting mystery or the critical role of parenting in shaping future generations, Dr. Aronson brings warmth, wit, and evidence-based wisdom to every conversation. So get ready to learn, get ready to laugh a little bit, and just transform your understanding of how health and relationships really do coincide. They matter. So help me join Dr. Ricky to the show. Well, welcome, Dr. Ricky Aronson, to the Visibly Fit Podcast. It is so great to see you. Thank you for being on all the way from Melbourne, Australia. I know it's 2 a.m. your time right now as we record, so thank you.
Thanks so much for having me, Wendy. It's hard to look visibly fit at 2 a.m., yes.
Oh, you look visibly fit. I love it. You do. You look wide-eyed and bushy-tailed. It's great. Well, I am so just delighted to have you on because you are just you just have a plethora of information to share with us. And you are a doctor. You are an endocrinologist. Is that right?
Endocrinologist and a geriatrician, yes.
Okay. All right. So you have that going for you, and you are, you know, a husband, a father, you have all these, I guess, titles that are very important titles. And you have written several books. And it's interesting because I want to just talk about, first of all, what propelled you to start writing the books that you've written, because you've written books about raising children in it's called Spaceship Parenting, which I love that title. It's Raising Smarter, Kinder, and More Capable Children. You've written a book called Why Couples Drive Each Other Crazy and How to Fix It, and Cracking the God Code. And so these are not necessarily, you know, books you would think a doctor would write. So what was the culprit for writing these books?
Yeah, that's, God kind of led me on this path, I would say, which I don't mean arrogantly in the sense that I'm important and therefore God thought I should do this. But I think life does take certain turns where things, maybe you do them because they're good for you, not necessarily because they're good for the world. But I kind of hope that what I'm doing will help people and make the world a better place. So I've had a very, I guess, an unusual path to writing these books. And that was within medicine. I was promoted quite quickly up through the ranks as a doctor. And doctors have something called imposter syndrome. We all believe that we're not good enough to be doing what we're doing, and that it's all a bit overwhelming, and we think we're just getting lucky. And it took me quite a long time to appreciate why I was being promoted into leadership, and to understand what it was about me that was getting there. It took me a long time to believe that I actually had the abilities to do what I was being asked to do. And in that process, I started to become much more interested in leadership and human management within medicine. And ultimately, I ended up taking over a directorship at a tertiary hospital in Western Australia, where I was living for 20 years. And within that portfolio, I started to train other doctors in leadership and human management. So I ran courses for doctors to teach them how to manage their patients as human beings better, because doctors are often terrible at people, because we're humans like everyone else, and we go to medical school and we learn a lot of medical knowledge. And, you know, dealing with emotions and dealing with people is a greater part of medicine, as with any career, than medical knowledge, because you don't deal with diseases. You manage people who have diseases.
100%.
And if you can't, and if you can't instill confidence in those people, in what you're doing and what you're trying to get them to do, then you don't necessarily succeed in what you're trying to do in your career. And within medicine, you're leading a team of junior doctors and nurses and allied health professionals. So you have to learn to be a leader, both in the way that you treat your patients and the way that you manage your teams. And of course, being a leader is not about telling people what to do and being bossy. It's about engaging people and bringing them on board and inspiring them and giving them aspiration to become healthier, which is what you're doing.
And so being a servant leader, right?
Yeah. So it's rather funny how I ended up writing, because I was running all these courses and they were becoming very popular, and I was getting, you know, 50 specialists at my hospital coming to courses, which is actually a lot for a half day in a hospital, because people are busy and they don't want to attend things. And my wife decided to come to one of the courses, and she said to me, I'm sure I won't learn anything, but I need the continuing professional development points, so I'm just going to come. And so that was really very encouraging, obviously. So my wife came along and she absolutely loved it. And she said to me, wow, everyone loved what you had to say, and people were inspired by what you were saying and doing. You should write a book. And if she who must be obeyed said you should write a book, I was, wow, well, I can't disobey a direct order. So I started writing about human relationships and management, and I wrote a great deal. And now here's a funny thing for faith-based podcasts. God was very kind to me. He gave me a prolapsed disc in the neck. And so I couldn't, I woke up one day and I had no use of my left arm. So I did what all mature men do, and I went to gym, and I couldn't do push-ups because my left arm wasn't working. So I did the next mature thing, which is I always said, well, I'll go try it out on the pec deck. And it still wasn't working. I was like, no, my left arm's not working. Better go
home. You are a dude. So, yes.
And I was put off work for 2 weeks by a surgeon who said, I'm not allowed to move or I'm ending up having neurosurgery. And then he said, you're going to take at least 6 weeks off work after that. And that allowed me to sit at home and write, because I couldn't do anything else. So I ended up writing terms and terms of work about human relationships. And ultimately, that was refined, and I ended up recognizing that writing an encyclopedia of human management was too much. So I refined it into writing about parenting and bringing up children. But it's all really based on simple human management principles, which apply whether you're at work or whether you're at home, which I learned in sort of my experience as a medical leader.
I love that, because we are leaders everywhere we go, whether it's just in our family or if it's in our business setting, at our church. We have the opportunity to lead and lead well if we have the right tools and mindset and skills. And so I love that you're writing about this. I want to go back, because before the show, we talked a little bit about your faith. And I want to talk about your journey there, because you talk about how, I guess, God wanted you to write these books. And before, you would have never said anything about God, right? You were an atheist.
Yes, I shocked my school teachers. So I grew up in South Africa. You would have never guessed from the accent. Everyone in South Africa is a very religious country, actually, very much unlike Australia. Australia is a very secular country. And I shocked my teachers when I was five. I told them I didn't believe in God, and I thought it was the opiate of the masses and what people believed, to, because we fear our own mortality, therefore we've created God to protect ourselves from that fear. And I was very, so I went to a very religious school, Christian National Education School, and there was a lot of religion at the school, but I really was very antagonistic towards it philosophically. But I was never closed-minded about religion as such. I just didn't believe it was logical. I've always been very open-minded about truth. And coming back to some of the things that you were saying, I think that those are the things that have been lost in the modern West, is we no longer have a lot of leadership. We don't have leadership in politics. In many cases, we don't have leadership in the home. Parents don't lead their children anymore. We don't have leadership at schools, because schools have been disempowered and are no longer allowed to lead children. The children lead the schools, which is why they're so chaotic in many cases.
There's a breakdown in society, sure.
Yeah, so I was very open-minded about truth, which is the other thing that is out of fashion in the modern day, which people just don't believe truth is important. That's why we have my truth, which is an ironic term. So when I went to university and was doing medicine, the experiences that I had were very confronting, because it became very clear to me that it wasn't actually possible, that the world came about through random process, which is actually kind of an oxymoron, isn't it? Because random process doesn't really make sense as a term. There isn't such a thing. Processes are very directional and organized, and that's what we see in nature and what we see in the creation of the universe and the world, is everything has been very directional and very organized, and organized against all odds. So I came to realize through seeing how DNA works and how immunology works, and that it wasn't possible for there to be no God and no creator. And so ultimately I became a religious, so to speak. I think that word's hard, because I think religion comes with a huge responsibility in the way that you behave and what you need to then do with your life. It's much easier to be an atheist, because then you don't answer to anyone or anything. You just do whatever you feel like doing. So it was very confronting to actually start to believe in God and to take on the responsibility that comes with that. But there was no other option once it became clear to me that that was the truth. My wife, by the way, is also a doctor, also grew up secular, also went down the same path. So what was lucky and beautiful about it was that we did it together. And that was very important, because I think it's quite difficult for couples if they're pulling in different directions in terms of their values. So I ended up down a very different path, and I ended up lecturing, and I have been lecturing young adults and students for the last 20 years on God and science. And that was why I wrote the book, Cracking the God Code, was to talk about the things that I've been lecturing that have excited audiences for the last 20 years.
God and science intersect, right? And so do you recall, I just have to ask, do you recall the actual moment that it hit you as you were, you know, studying DNA and just where it, when it just kind of like the light bulb went on and you're like, wow, This is a game changer. There is this moment that there's been a shift in how I think about my being and God's creation.
Yeah, I think I'd like to say that the old you, I saw the light. I think it was more of a process, and I think in many ways that's more healthy. So I think one of the mistakes that people, I think it's amazing when people suddenly see God or suddenly see truth, that is, you know, they fall in love and from one moment to the next they love someone. I think that's beautiful. But I think most effective outcomes are achieved through process, because one of the mistakes that is also a problem in the modern world is this belief that everything should be and can be easy. Nothing worthwhile is easy. Everything that's worthwhile in the world takes hard work, whether it's marriage, bringing up children, relationships, friendship, religion. A relationship with God is actually like any other relationship. It's going to have its good and bad times. It's actually hard work. And the reason why God has made it that way is to make it meaningful, because if it was easy, it wouldn't be meaningful. So yeah, so for me, it was a process. And as I experienced science in a certain way, and as I started to look for answers, then I started to be more interested in the Bible, and I came to recognize that the truths and the morals and the what the Bible was doing was something which wasn't possible to deny, and it didn't make sense to have been written in the time it was written, because it's so progressive. You know, the legal system in the Bible is in many ways more sophisticated than the legal system we have now, and all the ideas about, you know, it was very unfashionable in those days to care about taking care of the poor and the ideas that being a political leader gave you a higher moral responsibility, not a lower moral responsibility. All these kinds of ideas were, you know, far beyond the time that they were experienced. But also things like prophecy are, to me, very interesting. And I do get, you know, if you want to have evidence of God, I think what you need to do in life is often explain something rationally and say, well, how would someone sitting writing a book thousands of years ago know that this was going to happen? And if a prophecy is really, really specific and there's evidence that that prophecy definitely existed in that, certainly in earlier times, then you have to explain, well, that doesn't make sense in a model of just pure protoplasm, that if we just made out of, you know, chemicals and there's nothing else in the world, how would chemicals predict the future? It's totally illogical. Dismissively, or it sounded very
condescending, that's right.
But logically that doesn't make sense.
Sure. No, I love it. And I don't know what you call the archetype or whatever, but with the Bible and how each prophecy connects with, I don't know if you've ever seen the illustration of how, you know, Old Testament, New Testament, how they connect, and it is literally just an incredible piece of work. And it's a miraculous read. You know, you're an author. I've written books. There's no way we could write on those in that way, right? And there's multiple authors, right? And they all connect.
Exactly. I think when George Orwell wrote 1984, I didn't think that he thought that would be the future. So, I think that you're absolutely right that it's very easy often. I think one of the mistakes that people make when they look at the world and they want to justify or rationalize their beliefs is they look at everything retrospectively instead of prospectively. And so it's very easy to look back at things in a different way and say, oh, well, you know, now that history's expanded, all of this kind of makes sense. But you've got to put yourself back in the situation of when that was written and then try and look forwards and say, how would someone write this then? It's very easy to see that history expanded in a certain way from there, but how would that person have known that? And that's a big, I have a chapter on that in my book. By the way, my book, Cracking the God Code, is actually a really fun book. I look a lot at scientific theories, by the way, as well. And I look at what they actually truly show, because what people are taught at school is not what science shows at all. And it's not about conspiracy theories, because it's very easy to verify what I've written and to go and look at the theories and see what people proved and what they didn't prove. Everything is very transparent, you know. It's very easy to check if things are credible and true. But what I write in my book, I've got a chapter called Going Forwards Instead of Backwards, where I basically show how the world has developed and animal life has evolved. And then I show how impossible it is for any of those things to happen if you actually start at the point that they're happening and now look forwards. And I show how crazy many of the scientific theories to explain away God actually are. And it's a really fun chapter.
That's good. That's good. I haven't had a chance to read all of your books yet, so I can't wait to read that one. That's going to be my
next. Cracking the God Code's not out yet, so.
That's the reason I haven't read it, because.
No, it's only coming out probably next month, I think. I mean, I don't understand publishers. Publishers are as mysterious as God.
They're on their own timeline.
On a higher level that humans can't always understand.
They know no time. Yes. That's
very
so good.
Clever.
Well, looking forward to that one for sure. And so those of you that are listening to this podcast, make sure that you go and check out everything that Dr. Ricky has written and be on the lookout for Cracking the God Code. I think that will bless a lot of people that are listening right now. And it's drrickyaronson.com. I'll put that in my show notes. But I want to get into so much more. We could probably be on this podcast, I'm already thinking, for like 2 or 3 hours, but we don't have that kind of time. But let's talk a little bit, since you're an endocrinologist and this is a health podcast, let's talk a little bit about, hormones, right? Let's talk about relationships and hormones and marriage and, sex. Let's talk about all that, right? That a lot of people don't want to talk about, and yet they know that they need to talk about it, but maybe they're embarrassed to talk about it. And I think this will be a really good topic, especially a lot of my listeners are women midlife age. And, I think it's just an important topic that we dive into, and there not to be any shame or condemnation around it, but just to have a solid, good conversation around hormones and where women probably are in this stage of their life and maybe where their husband is at and maybe why things aren't the way they used to be, or maybe they have to work a little harder to make it the way they used to be, that kind of thing. So you go ahead.
Well, one of my friends who was head of a major endocrinology service in Western Australia, his mom said to him, "You men will never understand menopause. And what's the point having a son who's an endocrinologist if you can't understand menopause?" So he couldn't really win that argument. Look, I think what you've touched on there is a fascinating question, and again, a very broad question. I think we're living in a time that seems to want to deny that men and women are different. And of course we are. Women and men are fundamentally the same, because we're both humans and human beings have very similar needs. So humans need love and affection and to be valued by their partner and et cetera, et cetera. And so there's far more about us that is the same than that which is different. But of course the differences are what interest us and what become more pronounced in a relationship. And so what attracts us to each other are the differences. So males and females who are heterosexual find the opposite sex, the things about that person that are different. So I don't find muscular, hairy people attractive. I find other body shapes very exciting. And women are often the opposite. So although it doesn't seem like anyone finds hairiness that attractive anymore, unfortunately. So So I think that that's something which become very confused in modern society, and suddenly now normal sexual attraction, which is really the magic that attracts men and women to each other, has become quite demonized, and people can't distinguish. Even my daughter, who's 14, gets a lot of messages at school. And she's got three older brothers and me. And she gets quite cross when we start to talk about finding women attractive. And finding women attractive is something normal and healthy for a man. And it's something which society is built on. We couldn't survive as a species if we didn't find each other attractive, because that's what...
Right.
And actually, it's a beautiful gift from God, because there is such magic in sexual attraction. And it's actually there as a gift to bind a couple and to bring a psychological, spiritual, and physical closeness to that couple. And of course, sexual relationships are very complicated, because humans are complicated and there is such high emotion associated. So those things have all become very confused. When it comes to
because
middle
of
age,
the perversion of a lot of it, right? And with so much of it in people's faces because of social media and any kind of media, it's made it more perverse than how God intended it to be. Beautiful 100%. And wonderful and for procreation, right?
100%. Yeah. And if we remember the creation of humanity, when God creates humans, he creates us with moral responsibility. So the thing that actually makes us human is that we are created in the image of God, that we actually have the power to make moral choices. And so anything that is of value in the world, anything power that we have is in a sense a godlike power, which we can use for doing good and making the world a better place or for destruction. And so sexuality is a very, very powerful force that can be used for to build a family, which is the most beautiful, powerful, positive thing, or to destroy the world, which is unfortunately what many people do use it for. So yeah, so healthy sexuality, I think, has become very confused, and people are losing sight and being propagandized as to what healthy sexuality actually looks like. And there is such a thing as healthy sexuality and things that are actually not that healthy.
Right.
In the context,
and just the moral pollution that has occurred. You know, it's just really decaying. And I believe that that's probably a big piece of the equation. Like you're saying, this is a moral obligation. This is a moral issue more than it is a sexual understanding of one another. It's really a decay in our morality, right?
I think that very powerfully, that is exactly what it reflects. And, you know, culture, as much as culture influences society, obviously society influences culture. So when you see things coming through in culture, they also reflect what the underlying moral and value fabric of that society is. And so we do have a tremendous decay of sexual morality. And the idea that sex is a commodity, which is what is very strongly promoted in the press, and free sex, and, you know, it's just like scratching your back. You should have sex with whoever you want to, because, you know, why wouldn't you? Two consenting adults should do whatever they want. Whilst you can get away with doing that, the reality is sex is very powerful and has a huge emotional impact on people. And so it's actually, when we talk about truth,
and spiritual,
it isn't true. Yeah,
and spiritual
it isn't
impact.
True. Yes, and more so on women than men, which is also the great lie that's being told in the press, is if men can be sexual predators, why can't women also be sexual predators? And you're sexist if you say otherwise. Well, the problem with women being sexual predators is that women are much more emotionally connected to memory than men. And that's, I could give you all the studies about that, because they're actually quite fascinating. But women connect much more powerfully with experience and memory than men, which is not because men are not emotional, but if you go to a car accident scene, there's often women standing around crying. I've seen this many times, and their men are posturing and shouting or talking, you know, but they're not crying. And in classrooms, I know I've got a teenage daughter. Boy, is that a new experience for an
for
adult.
Some crying.
A very emotional period in life. And I've got three teenage boys. I can tell you that it was not nearly as emotional. So women are much more emotionally connected to experience than men. And so for them, sexuality is actually very profoundly emotionally affecting. And so whilst everyone can do whatever they like, people don't realize that there are emotional and spiritual consequences for our actions and decisions in life. And so what the press is leading people to do is actually spiritually damaging to them and emotionally damaging.
I was just going to say, it's not only damaging to them, but it's also the ripple effect of those around them, because it just, the way you operate once you are in an unsteady emotional state, and maybe there's some soul ties that need to be severed, that kind of thing, it just causes a disruption and a decay with everything around you. And the important part is that we understand the confinement I don't want to say the word confinement, that doesn't sound positive to me, but it is in a marriage of sex in a marriage, and how important that is to, you know, even if there's been issues in the past, you can work that out, right? I mean, there have been marriages that have come out stronger after they have talked through some things, and maybe there was miscommunication and things happened and there was just a breakdown within the marriage and different things happened. But they can come back together and make it stronger. But that goes through a lot of counseling, a lot of grace, a lot of compassion, a lot of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a big piece. But that doesn't have to happen. Like if you have a healthy sexual relationship within your marriage and it's communication as well, then that never even crosses people's minds. So I kind of want to talk about that, right? Like let's talk about how to keep a marriage healthy and that that never even becomes an issue to begin with when there's communication. Yeah, and yes.
Well, you've raised so many interesting points, and I never did get to talk about the challenge of people aging and how that affects marriage and sexuality.
Oh, sorry about that. Oh my goodness. Welcome to my mind.
Zing, zing. But we'll get to that. I think that this, you know, I'm actually a part-time comedian as well, and I love to be funny and make jokes, and these topics are really serious and it's hard to make light of them. So I have to give a really serious answer to what you've just said, because it is really quite serious and intense. I think in a very simple equation, what we were talking about earlier is responsibility. And yep. One of the mistakes of the modern West is to focus on rights instead of responsibilities. So everyone keeps talking about, this is my right. I deserve this. I have a right to this. I have a right to that. And relationships are built on responsibility. And if we go back to what I was saying earlier, that God actually created us unique from everything else in creation by giving us moral responsibility. So when it comes to something like a marriage or sexuality, the key ingredient of what defines us as human, what actually defines us as human and not animals, is our ability to behave morally responsibly. So when people behave irresponsibly sexually and they don't care about the consequences of their actions, because when you have sexual relationships where you don't care about the other person, you're just doing it for yourself, there is no responsibility in that. So that then right. becomes, by definition, by religious definition, that's actually an animalistic act, because what defines you as human is being morally responsible. So if you're doing things that are totally just for gratification, that's just the same as what an animal can do. Animals can also eat for pleasure and mate for pleasure, but they don't take moral responsibility for those acts. So within a relationship,
it's allowing the flesh to lead instead of living.
Yes, correct. Instead of
spiritual.
The soul.
Yeah, the soul.
So within a marriage, the same applies when it comes to marriage or sexuality, that the big deal is responsibility. What are my responsibilities to the other person? So the greatest relationship in marriage is one where both partners are entirely preoccupied with the needs of the other. And if you have a relationship where both people just care about the needs of the other person, then you obviously have a perfect relationship because both people have their needs met all the time.
Yeah, and like how can we outserve one another, right?
Yeah. And sexuality is a difficult area in that, because it's unusual for any two people to have exactly the same needs in anything. We all have different tastes in food and people. And, you know, my wife finds men attractive and I find women attractive. So we don't share, you know, we have different tastes in things. So within sexuality, the likelihood that both partners want exactly the same thing all the time is when do any two people want the same thing? Well, I suppose we all want pizza and chocolate and all the time. But so I think within that, there is an issue of responsibility and respect and concern. And what you've said, communication is a big deal. But fundamentally, if both people are very concerned about the needs of the other person, then that should make sexuality work. Of course, that's easier said than done. And within that, there has to be some flexibility. And sometimes someone's going to be disappointed. Someone's going to work harder than they intend to. But if you're working together as a team, isn't that what teamwork is, you know?
Yes.
That's how any team works, is there are going to be days where someone has to pull harder. Sounds like a terrible term in what we're talking at the moment, but I don't mean it like that. But there's always going to be times where certain team members have to graft harder at certain things than other team members. And the other team members inspire them and pull them along and support them, and you work through it as a team. So all of these things are what go into a healthy sex life. I think speaking to that in the modern day, again, with this idea that everything in life should be easy, and you have movies where people are constantly screaming in extreme sexual pleasure, you know, and everything just works all the time and it's amazing all the time. That isn't how sex works in real life. As with anything else, things that are worthwhile take hard work. The relationship takes hard work. The sexual relationship takes hard work. And so what's happened in, and we're actually seeing this as one of the many mental health epidemics, which I see in my practice. By the way, middle age is another epidemic of mental health issue that you were raising earlier, and I'll come to that later, is that young people have sexual dysfunction because their expectations of sex are wrong. So they've been brought up by media that sex is easy and should always be unbelievably pleasurable and fantastic and easy.
Well, there's an epidemic of an addiction of pornography.
Correct. And so all of these things raise different kinds of expectations and ideas that are unrealistic. And therefore, sex is actually becomes disappointing, dysfunctional, and difficult. And once things are dysfunctional and difficult, what do people do? They either respond to that by withdrawing, or they respond to that in a sort of hyper-vigilant way, so fight or flight. And so they start to do more and more crazy things to try and get what they think they should be getting. And that really doesn't work either. And in a marriage, that's definitely not going to work.
Well, they're after that extreme dopamine hit that they were. Yeah. So it's interesting for sure. So, yeah, you're right. It definitely takes just like anything, just like with your health and your well-being, you know, you have to work at it. You have to be disciplined in how you're eating, disciplined in how you move your body. Same within a marriage, same within the sexual context of that marriage. And so if you stop working at it, then you get flabby, you get saggy, it goes away. You know what I mean?
That's a very funny thing you raise.
If you don't use it, you lose it kind of thing.
Yeah, and I have that with my patients. So I, as an endocrinologist, I deal a lot with diabetic patients and patients who are dealing with weight issues. And then I give them healthy lifestyle ideas. And they often say, well, how long do I have to do that for? And I'm like, well, till you die. Like healthy lifestyle is kind of like, you know. It doesn't go away. So
yes. So it's a mindset.
By the way, there's nothing that offends my patients more than encouraging them to exercise. They look at me like I'm a devil.
Like it's like a curse word. Yeah.
How can you ask me to do that?
Yeah. So then it goes back, right? It really is a mindset, and it's a worthiness of taking your health serious, or your marriage serious, or your whatever relationship it is serious, and doing the work, doing the reps, because that's what it takes. I don't care if it's your finances for your business, just like with you writing books and being a doctor and a comedian, you're working at all those different avenues to make it work.
100%. And I think one of the things that people underrate, it's actually not so much in my books, but it isn't what I teach doctors. And that is, when your life starts to unravel and things are out of control, one of the ways to gain back control is actually to go back to a routine. And the more that things have fallen apart, the more important routine is and the more rigid it needs to be. So you go back to a really rigid routine. And if it comes to something like exercise, if you're not a person that exercises, you get yourself into a very rigid routine where on Mondays at 6 a.m., you go to gym every Monday at 6 a.m. and you go to gym every Wednesday at 6 a.m. or whatever you do. And then as those things become habits, things become easier, and then the routine can become less rigid. And that goes for people who've lost control of their work schedule, because doctors do that a lot. It goes for humans who are struggling with any aspect of life, and it goes for marriage. So routine is actually important in a marriage that's struggling. What does that mean? It means putting aside very specific time to grow your marriage and having a routine and saying, on Wednesday nights, we don't do anything but spend quality time together, whether that's intimacy. That intimacy is not just about sex. Intimacy is about spending time talking, being close, growing your emotional side, talking about the things that are troubling you in life, sharing emotion. Yes, sex is important. And if you're really struggling with your sex life, actually putting aside time is important. And that's what a lot of people in the modern day don't do, is they become so chaotic that they don't actually put aside time for any of the things that are important. And if you don't put aside time for something, it's going to decay and die, because the more you invest in things in life, the more important they become to you. So investment leads to greater outcomes. So the more you invest, the greater your outcome. And if you stop investing in your marriage, you stop investing in emotional sharing, you stop investing in sex, you stop investing in intimacy, then all of these things are going to die and they will no longer be meaningful to you because you're no longer putting any effort into them and they fall aside. And I think that's a huge problem in our busy, so-called busy lives that we lead nowadays. People have so much distraction and they're on their screens so much that they're not spending enough time loving the person sitting in front of them that needs love. And that person's also on a screen, not appreciating that they need to love their partner as well. Screens don't give cuddles.
Yeah, they don't, do they? And screens are just a way to numb out and ignore and just set aside and continue to not acknowledge what's really happening right in front of them. But also, you talked about the person right across from you, but what about the person right there using the screen, like yourself, that you need to pay attention to? And like we were saying, getting into a routine of exercise and that kind of thing. But it's more than that. It's loving yourself well, because, you know, one of the things that, that God tells us is to love your neighbor as yourself. But if you don't love yourself, how can you love your neighbor? And so there's That's part so of that true. Equation. Yeah. I'd love to unpack that a little bit more with you too, especially with your patients.
Yeah, sure. So I think also with my books, just to say that one of my favorite chapters of my book on parenting is one about screen addiction. And it's about how screens impact children and their emotions and physical development. And there's a huge amount of evidence that links time spent on a screen to poorer developmental outcomes, physically, psychologically, emotionally. And of course, we're designed to get affirmation and happiness from each other. And so you don't get that from a screen. But there are so many, as everyone's well aware, there's so many other dangers of screen addiction besides all the physical, emotional, and social outcomes, which are poor. Is the influences. The more time you spend, you allow your children to spend on screens, the more they're influenced by people other than the influences you want them to have. Because they're not usually listening to sermons about godliness and better behavior when they're on their screens.
No, their algorithms are a little bit different than yours, probably.
Correct. So I have got a whole chapter on that and how to manage that better. And in saying that, I think that I wouldn't like to give the impression that that means that I manage it perfectly and that I manage it perfectly with my kids. But I think having the aspiration to have time, I've got one of my terms in my book is disconnect to connect. Is to make sure that you're having dinner together as a family without your screens and actually talking to each other, to go out into nature together and turn off your phones. And in fact, there was a study in England that showed that families that eat dinner together have much better emotional outcomes and much better future relationships and better general psychological outcomes in their children than those that don't, which makes sense. So I think screens are a huge deal in the modern world. And fascinatingly, humans take a number of generations to appreciate the extreme danger of addictions. So if you look historically at opium or alcohol or smoking, it's taken people a long time to appreciate just how dangerous these addictions are. And no one proposed that smoking and alcohol were bad for you. You know, 100 years ago, it was
doctors were promoting it.
Well, not this doctor.
Ricky. No.
Yeah. So, So I think with screens, we have the same problem that there's actually this massive body of evidence of how dangerous they actually are to children. And yet we're sticking a screen in front of our children all the time. So it has a huge impact on relationships. And when people say they don't have time for anything anymore, it's interesting if someone analyzes, you've got that thing in your phone that tells you how many hours you're actually spending on your screen a day. So you don't have time for things because you're spending far too much time with your phone. And nobody feels emotionally fulfilled. No one feels better from spending time with their phone. Most people feel a sense of emptiness from it and deep down kind of regret, why did I spend the last 2 hours attached to my screen? So it's just such a profound challenge for humanity, and it's one which we're not really coming to grips with yet.
Right. The reality of the epidemic of loneliness is really it's really devastating, and yet people think they're not lonely until they stop the scroll and then it sets in, right? Because that dopamine hit has quit and they're no longer getting that hit. And then they are sitting with themselves and they're like, whoa, where is everybody? I don't have anyone around. I'm a little lonely. And so people are more lonely than ever and just don't realize it because they're living other people's best lives, looking at their vacation pictures rather than going on vacation themselves.
And worse than that, when they do go on vacation, they experience it through a screen, not through their own eyes. So God was trying to give us amazing senses, you know, sight and hearing and smell. So when you're, I went zip lining in Thailand and it was in a jungle. It was beautiful. And everyone there had a selfie stick and they were doing, they were experiencing it through their screen. So while they're going down the zip line, they're holding a phone and watching the jungle go past on a screen.
I have been guilty of it.
Stay at home and watch the screen. Watch it on the big screen at home. Your screen is too small. So I think that's crazy. And you really
like
want
live,
to be,
live,
yeah.
live
and
in
that's
the
why
present.
Dogs are so happy, because dogs actually are live in the world. They live in the moment. They actually experience the world around them all the time. They find an interesting scent on the pavement. It's like, wow, this is so awesome. I don't think you'd probably find the same scent awesome, but they do. And they see you and they haven't seen you for like 1 minute. It's like, you're the best person in the world. I love you. But there's a lot to be learned from that because they're so happy. So our problem is when we disconnect from the world, we stop being happy. And that's an obvious thing, because how do you create happiness? By experiencing one happy moment after the next. How do you experience happy moments? You have to actually stop and appreciate things that are happy to be happy. And if you're never stopping to appreciate the good things in life and really experiencing them, you're denying yourself being happy, because nothing is good and nothing's happy unless you stop to actually appreciate it, engage with it, and indulge in it. So you've got to appreciate the person you love. Otherwise, you stop appreciating the person that you love and they feel unappreciated. What's happening? Your relationship's growing apart. So these things sound almost quite trite to say them, but they're human lessons that we are unlearning. I was saying to you earlier, I don't think progressive as a term is true, because I think progressive politics are actually very regressive. And we are regressing away from human happiness. And that's why we have a mental health epidemic, because we're actually regressing away from the things that make people happy. And one of those things is a happy family. And so when you have a world that actually degrades motherhood, that it's not important to be a mother, it's much more important to be rich, which is really what we're learning. It's very sexist to say that a mother should value being a mother. I mean, my wife's a doctor, but if you offered her the choice between taking care of her kids or being a doctor, she'd take taking care of her kids every day of the week. And that's not because I'm a sexist husband, because my wife is definitely not someone who kowtows to me and does what I tell her. And she's a very capable, successful person. But ultimately, that is actually what makes humans happy. The reason why women have babies on average is not because of some sexist plot against them. It's because they have a powerful genetic drive to have children. They want to, and it gives them fulfillment. And what makes people happy? Existential fulfillment. So we have a society that's teaching women, don't do the thing that's actually going to make you happy, and definitely don't value that thing, because what you should be doing to make you happy is being a successful businesswoman and ordering people around. So that,
then
these,
we could
these are lessons
go
that
on
are
the
regressive.
Tangent about pro-choice, pro-life. That's why all that's an issue now, because the deception that women need to be working and that's going to make you happy. And no, being the mother is going to make you happy. So anyway, it doesn't mean that there's no challenge in being a parent, but it is the best job in the world. And I'm a Gigi. I'm a grandma as of late.
You look much too young for that.
Thank you. But it is just a joy. And these are the things that we live for. And that's the richness of life is doing what we're called to do, and that's to be just all that God has for us, and that's to procreate and to, like you said, nurture our families and be involved and that kind of thing. But I love everything that you're saying. You are just wise, over and beyond your doctorate and your comedian skills. But you know what? Most comedians I've ever met are highly intelligent. By the way, I'm sure you already know that, but you almost have to have that, to have that wit and to be so fast. But
Which is interesting, by the way, because women find humor very attractive in men.
My husband is so funny. Yes, I love my husband's humor. Yes.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting thing. But if you look at the social dynamic of young people when they're socializing to meet a partner, the men just constantly try to make the women laugh. And I remember being a teenager, it was like, if there was a really, I know this is terrible to say, but a really pretty girl, it was like a major victory if you could get her to laugh. And all the guys would be competing to make her laugh. So isn't that such an interesting thing? Because what you're saying is that humor actually implies a certain level of intelligence, because to be funny, you need to be able to take a situation, think about it, and create some insightful twist on that situation to make people laugh. And so, yes, it is a, so in other words, when women are looking for a partner, what are they looking for fundamentally? Someone who is going to be nice to live with, and certainly making you laughing is a big part of being happy in life. So if someone can make you laugh all the time, your life is much happier, but also
Laughter is good medicine.
Yeah. Good gene
pool. The Bible tells us
that. If someone's intelligent, they're more likely to, not that people who aren't, intelligence, by the way, is a very broad term, because people are intelligent in different ways. Some people are emotionally intelligent. They get people, which is a big problem, obviously, which we were chatting about earlier about medicine, is that doctors are not always, there's emotional intelligence and intellectual intelligence are not the same thing at all. So some of the most emotionally intelligent people aren't necessarily good at studying and doing well at school. And people who are good at studying and doing well at school are not necessarily emotionally intelligent. And they're two totally different domains, which some people have both and some people have not, more of one or the other. But emotional intelligence is such an important thing to get ahead in life. And I think to be a comedian requires emotional intelligence, because it's all about reading an audience as well. So, you know, that's a huge part of making people laugh, is to get the vibe of an audience, which requires a degree of emotional intelligence to understand what, and when I stand up, I do a lot of medical lecturing. I do it professionally as well, in the sense that people actually hire me to come and run medical events to make people laugh. So, and a big part of that is often I turn up and I find certain jokes, a certain style of humor isn't working for a certain audience. So I need to be very much in that zone where I'm feeling what the people in the crowd are feeling, not what I want to tell them, not the jokes that I want to make, but what is going to make this group of people laugh? What is their dynamic and what vibe am I getting from that? And that's a hugely important part of humor and being, I'm not calling myself a comedian because I think that's a very strong, like, are you a comedian? Well, I have an ability to make crowds laugh.
If you're getting paid to do some comedy, I would say that's the definition of comedian, right?
Well, you know, there's not many funny doctors around. They're quite serious
people. That's right. We need more funny doctors.
Well, the problem is I've actually written a comedic show, which I haven't got up and running. It's called Laughter Isn't the Best Medicine. Because actually, if you went to see a doctor and they said, hey, you know, you've got cancer, and then they started laughing, I don't know if that really would be the best medicine at all. So,
okay, good point. Good point. But there is something about laughter that does release positive, healthy hormones, as you know, and that can help in your healing process. So there's 100%. That part to it.
100%. Actually, it's really fun when I have patients that do laugh. And that, again, comes down to reading the room, because you have patients who really want you to be very formal and treat them in a certain way and just give them the facts. And those are patients you really don't want to start cracking jokes in front of. And then you have some patients that come into the room and it's clear from the beginning that they're up for a laugh. And those are the most fun appointments, because even when you're dealing with health issues, laughing is, and this is another modern malady, isn't it? A perversion of the world is this idea that making jokes is offensive, that you offend people by making
jokes.
You don't make jokes about things to offend people. We make jokes about things because it's such a beautiful human coping mechanism which God has given us to make the world a better place and to cope better with the world, because it's very hard being a human being. All human beings have to face other people dying, friendships breaking down, relationships not working, disappointment, rejection, emotional pain. And if we can't laugh, then how do we deal with that? So this whole idea that if you make a joke that I don't like, it's offensive, is a big problem. And it certainly changed the way I do comedy, by the way. So I'm very much more cautious now with medical students, with when I stand up to do stand-up comedy with doctors. I'm very much more guarded in certain kinds of jokes that I can't make that are actually very funny often, but I recognize that it's become very risky to be funny. You have to be cautious about, because if you make the wrong joke, then you get canceled and you get into real trouble, even though you're not actually a sexist or a racist. I mean, I really do love humans. I know it sounds crazy. My wife always sort of chides me for that because she's a bit more cynical than I am. But
I
really do love
too.
Humans. Yeah. And I love people of all colors and persuasions and ideas. And if a patient comes to see me, I'm intensely emotionally concerned that I really help them. But sometimes humor crosses a line in a sense, because that's what's funny is kind of, and you can show things by making jokes about things. So often you're satirizing something or showing through farcical humor how stupid something is. You're not promoting that idea. You're actually sending it up to show people how stupid is this. So I think we live in very strange times that are ever more complicated. And I feel for our kids, because I think dating and, it's become so complicated for young people. It was complicated enough in your and my day, you know, men and women, when they mix together, they're a complicated mix. But now with all these crazy new ideas that are being thrown around, it's made it so much harder for them.
Yeah. Thanks, TikTok. We're made in God's image, and laughter is something that God created. And so I think God has a great sense of humor. And I giggle a lot because God shows me hearts, like in the sky in a cloud, or when I'm out walking in a rock, or so, I just see hearts everywhere. And it just warms my heart and it makes me giggle. And he sends me just these little things right when I need it. Or he sets up something that is just really funny. And so I'll have this kind of dialogue with the Lord about it, and we kind of giggle together, you know, and I love that. And I think we don't need to be so serious with life. And I think that is one of the problems with this day and age, is that we're so serious. And it's like, wow, can't we just like let it go and be chill and, you know, laugh it off a little bit? I mean, there are some serious things, but
there's a fascinating aspect of that. In terms of both, so I've written a book about male-female relationships, which, by the way, is mostly funny. I laugh a lot about all the things that irritate women about their husbands. So it's quite
self-deprecating. Is that the Why Couples Drive Each Other Crazy?
Yes, it's a very self-deprecating book, because a lot of it is about why men do the things they do that irritate their wives so much.
Oh, good, yes.
Because it's always the same. That's something that fascinated me, is that couples will fight about the same things. That part of what inspired me to write the book is that couples all fight about the same things, and you get married and you think you're so unique and special, and then you get together with all your friends and all the men are complaining about the same things about their wives, and the women are complaining about the same things about their husbands. And so
you mentioned the one thing about how, sorry to interrupt, but how men can never find the thing that we say, hey, go get whatever from the refrigerator, and they can't see it and it's right there. And I mean, I talked to my mom about it. I talked to girlfriends. All the men are the same. They're like, what is that? How come they can't see it?
That's in my book. There's actually a whole section on why men can't find things in cupboards. And I explain physiologically why that's the case, because it is ubiquitous and universal. And also things like how women multitask. Do they multitask? Is it actually what they're doing? It actually isn't what women are doing. They actually don't multitask. I'm just diverting somewhere else because we've gone in this direction. But women actually don't multitask. They have a much more magical ability than that, which is actually quite fascinating, which is that men are tunnel vision is how we operate. So we're very focused. We see a target and our eyes lock on that target, and it's all that we see. And that's why we can't find things in cupboards, by the way, because if the thing we're looking for looks in any way slightly different to what we are seeing as the target, we can't see if the butter's got a different label or it's behind something else. Our eyes are laser targeted on what we think should be the target. But women actually don't multitask. They actually have this ability to have multiple balls in the air at once and keep some sense, some magical sense of where each ball is, and sort of pluck it out the air when they need it and use it, but at the same time retain this magical sense of all the other balls in the air at any given time. And so if you take, for example, my wife, and probably you and many women, my wife could run a work Zoom meeting while she's cooking. And at the same time, she's not going to forget to pick up the kid from tennis at 4 and, you know, where the other child is, and one's doing their homework, and everything is in the air, all these different balls. She has a sense of where they all are, and when they're needed to, each one is brought into the right place at the right time. Whereas men, if I've got one thing in front of me, if I'm cooking, I'm going to cook one pot and that's it. That's the thing I'm doing. And
so
I can't
good.
Be talking on a phone. So I'll tell you a funny story about that. COVID, obviously Zoom became this big deal. And I'm sure you've used Zoom. Everyone's used Zoom. And there's a feature in Zoom where only the person speaking appears on the screen as opposed to seeing everyone's faces. So my wife, when she was using Zoom, she had that setting on her Zoom that she could only see the person speaking. So she presumed that was how Zoom works. Now, my wife's actually a medical inventor. She's invented a medical device which is progressing very well. It's a device to access veins in people with difficult veins so that anyone can use it and people don't get jabbed multiple times when they go to the hospital. So the device enables you to find veins very easily and access them with venous access. And she was in this company and she's on all these Zoom meetings. And at some stage, because my wife is a woman, controversial, she was busy hanging, washing and cooking and doing a million things while she was in all these business meetings. And one day, she didn't realize that actually everyone can see what you're doing. So at some stage, one of the other directors of the company said to her, she was talking and they said, yeah, it's been really fun watching you cook and hang washing and do all the household stuff the last 2 months during these meetings. And she was so embarrassed because she didn't realize that.
Well, thank goodness she didn't go to the bathroom.
Yeah. No.
That would have been horrible.
She's much too dignified for that. And besides, do women even go to the bathroom? I don't think they do. So that's only something that men do.
Oh, Dr. Ricky, you are just a joy. This is so fun. And just the way men think and women think, it's kind of indicative of this whole conversation, because I've been throwing things at you left and right, but you've actually picked it up pretty well and ran with every ball I threw at you. So way to go. And you were able to kind of bring it back, because that's how men roll. You're able to focus and get it back to where we needed it to go. So, and that is on your books and your mission to help people just transform their family and relationships. And we just appreciate all that you're doing. And I'm so glad that your wife nudged you to write these books. So those of you that are listening, go again to drrickyaronson.com. And that's where you can find his books, Why Couples Drive Each Other Crazy, Spaceship Parenting, and Cracking the God Code, coming out soon. So thank you, Ricky, so much for coming on. Do you have anything you want to share just to kind of wrap this up, or maybe just something funny that we don't know about you? I mean, I didn't know you were a comedian, but now I know that.
Well, at two in the morning, I'm much less of a comedian, apparently. But,
you're doing pretty well.
So, well, thank you. Well, I'll tell you, actually, yes, if you want me to tell you a funny story, which is actually a true story. At two in the morning, I was just reminded of it, men and women at two in the morning. So in South Africa, there's a lot of crime. And so one of my friends, he woke up in the middle of the night and there was an intruder in the bedroom with him and his wife. And so he started shaking his wife to wake her up. And she rolled over and she said, "It's 2 a.m., not now." So so that's 2 a.m., yes. So she was like, "Oh, not now, really." And it's like, no, there's a intruder in the room. Anyway, they survived, which in South Africa is a good thing. Yeah, so just to say, as a very positive thing, first of all, just thank you so much for mentioning my books. They really are fun. They're actually very comedic books and very fun, but they do lay out the fundamentals of relationships. And my big message is that humans are happy because of the success of their relationships. And it seems a great pity that we don't teach people how to be better at relationships. And that's kind of been my mission in my books, is to give really simple, easy lessons about how do I become better at relationships, how to become a better husband or wife, and how do I become a better parent. And those things are evidence-based and easy. But I do want to give one key message, and that is that it's very easy, and I gave this message to a group of doctors last night as well that I was lecturing. It's so easy in this world to get taken up by the negativity that is constantly being promoted. And there's a reason why negativity is promoted, and that is that humans understand that people, when they drive on a freeway, they don't stop to look at beautiful flowers. They stop to look at an accident scene. So it's negativity and catastrophizing that attracts people to click on things, and that's clickbait. And being happy and celebrating family and important things that are important doesn't attract clicks, unfortunately. So what I would love to say to people is we're actually living in the best of times. We have hot showers and lots of food and delicious food.
Lots to be grateful for.
Yeah, lots to be grateful. Health that is unprecedented. That's what I was talking to doctors about, how there, when I was growing up in medicine, cancers that were incurable. If you had told me we would be able to cure those cancers during my lifetime, I would have said rubbish. But we are routinely curing many metastatic cancers and all these amazing things that are going on in the world, in the beautiful world that God's given us, is worth appreciating. And the only way to be happy is to stop and start appreciating and being grateful for our marriages, for our families, for what God's given us, for God, for this incredible world that we live in. Actually, it's beautiful and magic. And relationships, marriage, beautiful magic. Being a parent, beautiful magic. Just enjoy it. And we should stop worrying so much about how everything is terrible, because actually we live in an amazing world.
Amen. Drop the mic on that, Dr. Ricky. That's beautiful. Thanks for tying a bow on it and making it positive. We appreciate you. And thanks so much for your time, and go back to bed and get some rest.
Lovely spending time with you. Thank you.
Take care.
Well, that's a wrap for today's show. So thank you so much for tuning in. I love spending this time with you. To learn more and get more free resources, just head on over to wendypet.com. And thank you in advance for sharing this episode and this podcast, following and subscribing not only to this podcast, but finding me on social media, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, wherever you are, I'm probably there too. Until next week and our next podcast time together, make it a visibly fit day.